Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. Whole Foods Market is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and the Department of Transportation's Summer Streets, a three-day series of events dedicated to healthy, active living on the car-free streets of New York City. Join us at the Whole Foods Market City Picnic Area on 24th Street and Park Avenue the first three Saturdays in August. Find more information at the DOT's website, keyword Summer Streets.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border, coast to coast, and all the ships at sea. Streaming live from the County of Kings, Brooklyn, New York City, on the Heritage Radio Network. Are you ready for the fastest half hour on the internet today? It's the Mike and Judy Show. Spanning the globe for high-minded hijinks and lowbrow kicks to bring you the best in sex, drugs, rock and roll, and nuclear fission. Too bad for radio and too good looking for television. And now, here they are, America's last best hope to make the internet safe for absolutely no one. Two people who will do pretty much anything for a pizza. Your hosts, Mike Edison and Judy McGuire.
All right, welcome back to the Mike and Judy Show. I'm Mike Edison, and once again, surrounded by astonishingly brilliant women, but no one more so than my co-hostess with the mostest, the woman who was too hot for television, Judy McGuire.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Judy. Before we get to our guests, I think we need a little wee time. We need a little Mike and Judy time. What the fuck happened here last week?
Well, as the sober one, the designated driver last week, the non-smoker, I went home and I bought like three sandwiches, everything the Italian deli had to sell me. I was very suggestible, and I just went home, ate, and went to sleep. I don't even smoke the marijuana.
To recap, last week was Apotcalypse 2011.
Apotcalypse 2011.
I wish we could do that for... We should have that like a word of the day. And just do that every episode.
It was definitely a milestone, an experimental stoner radio. And you know what happened after we left? The Oprah Winfrey came by. The Oprah Winfrey, which, the great mystery, it was opium, cocaine, and reefer cigarette.
Oh, I'm glad we missed that one.
You know, I'm maybe too old to know better, but too young to care.
God.
So, today's show, we've got a great show. Today's a special punk rock DIY show. Introduce our guest, Judy, please.
Well, we have two fine fillies from Greenpoint.
Greenpoint represent.
We have Liz Nord, who's a documentary filmmaker who did this film Jericho's Echo, Punk Rock in the Chosen Land, and is working on a film called Battle for Jerusalem, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. And we have the fabulous Karen Rose, who just self-published a book called B-Sides and Broken Hearts. She does a Mets website fanzine.
Yeah.
Blog. I know nothing about sports, so that we'll keep that conversation kind of quick, but she's also a contributor to Backstreets, which is dedicated to my favorite New Jerseyite besides myself, Bruce Springsteen. Mike, I meant
to
say.
Well, you're putting the boss.
Bon Jovi.
Frank Sinatra.
Come on, Living on a Prayer. That's my go-to karaoke.
Duke Ellington.
Oh, you're younger though.
All right, the phone better start lighting up with proud Jerseyites representing. So here we are, DIY. You ladies did it yourself. You cut out the useless middleman, heretofore American tradition. Let's talk about self-publishing. Does it work?
Hey, Karen, why did you choose to self-publish?
So I wrote this book almost 10 years ago, and then found an agent, went through traditional, you know, my first reaction was, I'm DIY. I publish fanzines. Uh-huh. I had the first REM fanzine. I contributed to every New York fanzine back in the 80s. So I finished a book, and my reaction is, okay, I'm going to just put it out myself, because that's what you do, right? That's how we grew up.
Right.
You do your stuff, you put it out, you don't wait for someone else's blessing, you just do it. But everyone said, oh, no, you don't do that to yourself. Your stuff is too good for that. So I went through the traditional route of, you know, querying agents, getting, you know, I had, and it should have been like the overnight success story. I eventually had five agents offering to represent me. I chose an agent, and they said, okay, now we're going to sell this. And then they couldn't sell it. Every single publisher who liked it said, in the end, a version of, we really love this book and we love her writing, but we're just not sure how we're going to sell it.
Yeah.
So she said, go write another book, and then we can package the two of them together. But I couldn't write anything that she thought was good enough to package. And after she rejected my third manuscript,
ouch.
And, you know, also, to be fair, self-publishing has changed a lot. When I wanted to self-publish, it probably would have cost me close to $10,000 to get it out and do all the promotion myself and get my own copies. And now you can do it for next to nothing. I chose to spend some money on it because I wanted it to look super sharp, and so that nobody could use the, oh, it's formatted badly, as an excuse for rejecting it. But, you know, there's this guy, Joe Conrath, that your friend Barry Eisler, who we'll talk about, was also very against self-publishing until he realized how much money he could make and how much more control he would have and how much quicker the stuff would go out. Yeah. And I had friends of mine who were writers who were like, oh, I'll introduce you to my agent. You just have a bad agent, which I don't believe was the case.
It's a double-edged sword, I think, the self-publishing, the DIY thing. I mean, first of all, you control it and all the money comes back to you.
Right.
On the other hand, it's nice to have a professional publisher giving it the imprint of some legitimacy, which you may or may not need anymore, especially if you have a platform. If you're on the radio, if you have a popular blog spot. And I reckon blogs now are sort of like the modern version of fanzines.
Absolutely. That's how I always considered fanzines. I always considered, you know, I had the first Patti Smith, quote unquote, fanzine. My first website was called Radio Ethiopia. Because wasn't like, oh, I like the name of it. It was like because of like her whole treatise about Radio Ethiopia and that tirade on WBII back in the day.
But the problem is, while the barrier to entry went away, which is great because now we can do these things, we can make our books, we can make our radio shows. It's what we're doing here at Roberta's. I mean, you're too hot for television, Judy, so of course.
I know, I'd be breaking tubes all over.
We couldn't go down that route. But since there's a barrier to entry, too many people with serious talent deficit are getting in the game and diluting the water.
I don't see that, and that's where all the pro big publishing people are saying. The logic that people always give is, well, the difference between books and music is that if you're a band, you at least have that, you have to get up and perform in front of people, so that filters out the bad people. And I'm not really sure that's actually true.
Hi, Dave Matthews.
Well, also, there's a huge verb in do it yourself, right? This is Liz. Hi. the do part. And I think when it comes down to it, you know, you may not be investing as much money, or there's not a publishing company, or in my case, you know, a film studio investing as much money in you, but you're investing so much more time.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when it comes down to it, the people that are willing to really, really put in the time it takes to make some success on, you know, with a book or a film or independent music or whatever, like, maybe they suck, I don't know, but they sort of deserve
some people are certainly
the success
deluded as
they
to the value
like,
of their art. But let me ask you this, because making a film is an expensive proposition.
Yeah.
Writing a book, except for the sweat equity and time, basically doesn't really cost anything. There's no overhead on it. But making a movie is expensive.
Especially a movie in Israel.
Yeah.
When you live in Brooklyn.
You have to have equipment. I mean, you could write a book in a notebook and have someone type it for you. So, yeah.
But, and I had a similar experience, you know, in terms of my first film, which was actually a punk movie, so it kind of like all worked out in the end. It was called Jericho's Echo, Punk Rock in the Holy Land, as Judy mentioned, and it was about Israeli punk rockers and kind of looking at the situation in the Middle East from a whole other set of perspectives. And I wasn't a trained filmmaker. I'd always known I'd wanted to make films, but it was so expensive at when I first started out, to even think about it, because even the digital systems were $100,000. It just was not accessible. It started to become more and more accessible with digital technology getting cheaper. But even still, I went to a few like independent classes in San Francisco. You know, things there's a class everybody takes called Shaking the Money Tree. And it's basically like...
Wow, that should be like a mandatory college course for everyone.
It's a great... There's some great pointers there, but his whole... The professors, teachers, whatever, whole philosophy is like... You need to get money from rich people, which is, you know, great in theory. But I went to the class and I basically said, you know, what about someone like me who's really not well connected to wealthy people? And, you know, yeah. I don't really even know anyone I could go to. And he said, well, get to know them. That was his answer. Yeah. And I was so discouraged. I left that class and thought, I'm never going to make a movie. But then I realized, you know, again, that
she's gesturing at me. Since I had,
I'm gesturing. Sorry, I'm not used to this radio thing. I'm gesturing at my lovely co-guest. That basically, I came from a punk background where you know we realized we can do it ourselves, and I don't necessarily need to do it the same way everybody else says.
We took control of the medium because that was part of our message, was that we can do it. We weren't going to kowtow to large. That's how punk rock started, right? Yeah. It was against, you know, corporate rock sucks. Corporate rock still sucks, and we had to make flyers. We didn't have an internet or a MySpace page. You had to make the flyers. We were very competitive. My bands always were anyway. That our artwork looked as good as possible. We went around and we glued them on telephone poles on the sides of bars. But to get a gig, I had to go to the bar and wait for the guy. Yes. And if the guy didn't show up, I had to go to the bar again the next night and wait for the guy.
You had to bring a physical copy of your music. You couldn't just send a link to an MP3 on Bandcamp.
And also, recording studios were very expensive and difficult to use.
Right. Yep.
You know, it cost money. So there was a barrier to entry. And, you know, we managed to do it. The guys I knew, none of us had any money. You know, this was a self-financed project. And somehow we managed to figure it out, which is what I want to beg the question. What do you think about Kickstarter? I know, Liz, you used Kickstarter to raise some dough. And
No, she used another one.
Oh, Indiegogo, right?
Yeah.
Okay, still, it's internet panhandling, okay? To me. Tell me experience. Tell me how you're justified asking somebody to fund your art project, because personally, I never had the chutzpah to do it.
good word for my Israeli movies. I will say that, you know, I agree with what you guys were saying, that, you know, writing a book or doing certain things, it doesn't require the same kind of initial capital. When it comes down to it, you need some money to do a movie.
Yeah.
And so I've heard the term, when people talk about independent filmmaking, it's not really independent, it's interdependent. And I think that's kind of interesting. It's like the next level of DIY is this sort of community. It's not just you, but it's sort of the community pulling together to make something happen. And so with filmmaking, that really works because you need more hands, you need more brains, and you need some money. So when I first raised the money for Jericho's Echo, that first film, it was before Indiegogo and before Kickstarter, but it was when Howard Dean, remember him, had raised a bunch of money for his...
Dr. Howard Dean?
He raised a bunch of money online for his campaign, and it was the first time anyone had done it. Everyone thinks Barack Obama's the big innovator. Not true. Barack Obama really made it work, but Howard Dean was the first one that got a lot of small donations online.
Howard Dean is actually more popular than Barack Obama. Probably.
Well, right now, who knows? But anyway, so I took that model before there was an Indiegogo, before there was a Kickstarter, and I just set up a PayPal account on the website for Jericho's Echo before the film existed, and I started asking my friends for $10 here, $10 there. And I think that people felt... Like, I didn't feel bad at all asking for, because it was just a little bit of money, and people wanted to be on board. People wanted to be part of something. They weren't necessarily out doing their own band or making their own movie, but they could have been part of something.
Okay, so they get the feel-good thing of being part of something.
But
I agree.
But didn't
filmmaking is collaborative, but Judy, come on, put the smackdown on this, because I know how much you hate Kickstarter.
Well, you know what? I get stuff from people I haven't heard from in like 20 years going, oh, hey, how you doing? Why don't you visit my Kickstarter page? I'm doing like this thing. And I'm just like,
paying for your fucking band. Fuck you.
My friends have cancer and they need my money. You know, I'm not going to fund your 24 hours of painting in a room. You know, I'll send you a bagel or something maybe, but I'm just not going to do it.
But look, the arts have always required patronage. And these days, you know, it used to be only wealthy people could contribute to the arts, and the arts were then made for those wealthy people. Now, like, people can get $10 here, $10 there.
I think it's the overdose it's just the deluge of Kickstarter emails.
Look,
I totally agree.
Again, you know, when I was doing Jericho's Echo, it was before all that stuff, so I was actually kind of innovating at the time and using that sort of DIY spirit of like, how can I get this done? Now it's I definitely agree. It's overkill. I get invites all the time.
On a different level, because I occasionally go to see the symphony or the opera, and I'm on the mailing lists at Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're asking me for money to donate to Carnegie Hall.
They
I
ask
mean,
you for money. Hundreds
I mean,
of dollars.
For Carnegie fucking Hall? Do they know me? Have they been to my house? Because I got to pony up $125 just to see the opera or the symphony. And the truth is, classical music, so-called classical music, is an unpopular art form mm-hmm. that's very expensive to produce, and it doesn't happen without corporate grants and individual donors, which maybe on a large level doesn't make it any more different than punk rock. I give them my money at the box office, and I would do the same thing for my local band. I don't think I need to send them a check to help them make their record.
Didn't you go to shows sometimes to support the scene? Didn't you buy a record sometimes that you weren't sure you weren't going to like to support the scene?
I do it all the time. Once I get to a gig, I buy people's records.
Exactly,
and I
do that now with books. Like I will, if people who pitch my website, like, will you write about my book? I go to their website, I read about their book, and if I think their book is something I will like, I will just buy it as opposed to having them send me a free copy because I want to support the scene. And I think it depends on the project. And I don't know. I mean, are we being too precious? I don't know where the line is. I could see a movie about Israeli punk rock. Had I heard about it at the time you were pitching it, I would have been like, this is something I want to be part of. So I want to give money about it. But when I decided I was going to self-publish Besides and Broken Hearts, I started this whole Kickstarter plan, and then I looked at it and I said, wait a minute, I just want people to buy the book. I don't want them to give me $10 to put the book out. I want them to buy the book for $10
when
it comes out.
Well, someone sends you $10, they better get a copy of the book at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, I just decided that I would be spending time on Kickstarter as opposed to spending time on the marketing plan or sending out press copies.
It's very time-consuming to do those campaigns right, but I think, you know, a lot of, like, if you look at it more like pre-sales than a donation, you know, that's just another approach to it. Like, a lot of bands will say, buy our CD now before it exists.
Yeah,
but you know,
I think
that's fair.
That's fair. Hey, don't we have to go to a break?
Let's take a break. Once again, we're here on the Heritage Radio Network.
The fastest 30 minutes on the internet.
Broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant. We're here with Liz, Karen, and Judy. This is Ian Dury from Do It Yourself.
In the deserts of Sudan and the gardens of Japan, from Milan to Yucatan, every woman's every man. Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me, hit me. Schütter, ich liebe dich. Hit me, hit me, hit me. Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me slowly, hit me quick. Hit me, hit me, hit me.
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back with Liz Nord and Karen Rose. Liz, tell me about how did you get to Israel? Like, how come Israeli punk? How come the new movie Battle for Jerusalem?
And what is it about Jews and punk rock?
Okay, those are two different questions, but I'll try to do my best. Jews and punk rock, I'll give a plug for a friend's book. See, it all comes around. The Heebie-Jeebies at CBGB's.
Oh, that's
which
awesome
I'm buying
title
tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, that's so another anyways topic. I disagree strongly. I like the author. Actually, I have a photo of Dick Manitoba. My picture's in that book, but I do disagree with the premise of that book because, I mean, the Ramones were not informed by their Judaism.
You never know. It's pretty deeply ingrained shit. But anyways, the point is there's a lot of Jews involved in punk rock. And I will say, you know, to tie it into the punk rock thing, that I feel like Israel is a really complicated and misunderstood country. And
definitely,
I think, and who knows, I never really thought about it before, but it might be that sort of punk growing up, you know, ethos or whatever that, like, keeps compelling me to go back there and try to tell stories from that place that help unpack it a little bit, because it is just, you know, just like your average small town punk rocker, it's like a very
Well, Israel
misrepresented place.
Israel's a very fertile territory for punk rock and DIY.
It's also a place full of stories. So for a storyteller, absolutely. I mean, everybody there got there for, you know, in some crazy way, and you know, or family was there and had to leave, or you know, it's everyone has a story.
Correct.
There's
correct
nowhere
me
that
if
just
I'm wrong,
like
I believe
up.
The greatest story ever told actually happened.
there's some pretty important historical literature slash. Shit from God.
Yeah, I tell you, give me a country where there's mandatory conscription to the military, and that's where you're going to see some good punk rock.
But actually, no. And one of the, I lived in Israel for 6 years, and I worked for an Israeli record company, Head Artsy, and so, and I actually loaned my guitar on a regular basis to Ziknei Tzfat, who were my neighbor across the hall, Eshar Cohen, and they used to rehearse in my ex-husband's photography studio. So, and the fascinating thing to me about why there was not more punk rock in Israel, and I wish I could remember his name, and if I spent 10 minutes I would think of it. One of the sort of pioneers of Israeli punk rock said the reason there isn't more punk rock in Israel is because in America, when you're 16 and you're pissed off, you pick up a guitar. In Israel, when you're 16 and you're pissed off, you're given a gun, and so you don't have that teenage angst. And only recently, I think, with, you know, cutting down on the amount of commitment in the mandatory conscription, and people being able to opt out of it more easily, have people been able to sort of channel that into punk rock? Because it's not that Israel didn't want punk rock, they just weren't sure how to do it. And it was definitely considered outsider art. It was really considered
just like any other crime. You need motive and opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's still definitely underground there, the scene or whatever, which made it appealing because here it's just not. You can go to the mall and buy your, you know, studded belt at Hot Topic or whatever.
But I mean, Ziknei Tzfat, one of the first shows they played, they sold tickets to Stage Dive. They played at this club called Roxanne. They played at this club called Roxanne, which I used to DJ at with my friend Liron Tani. And they sold tickets to Stage Dive because they wanted to make sure they had stage divers people didn't know how to do it. The most we knew about how to stage dive was watching Pearl Jam videos on MTV.
Well, there are learning curves
in every culture.
I
was going to come here and learn something about Israeli.
Sorry,
that's
I didn't
exciting.
Really mean to get all over your stuff, but I actually do know a little
so
bit. Sorry,
yeah,
I had no idea of this connection.
That's hilarious.
You know, there's a learning curve to any culture you go to. I remember when I was on tour with my band Sharky's Machine back. 1,000 years ago, and we went over to East Berlin to do a gig. Okay, this is back West Berlin, East Berlin. The wall was still up. It was only really months before the wall came down, and no one was even talking about it at the time. The people in West Berlin, they had a complex relationship with the wall at the time. They hated it because it represented oppression, but they also liked it because it made them special.
Yes.
And they knew that when it came down, they were going to be overrun with refugees, and there were going to be food lines, and their world was going to change. They weren't going to be this weird jewel and in this oasis of the Soviet bloc country. Which is exactly what happened, but no one knew what was going to happen. Yeah. So anyway, so we go over to East Berlin. Somebody had a fanzine that they handed to somebody that they handed to someone, and you go over to East Berlin as a tourist, and you use German marks or American dollars. So they brought hard currency into the country. I think it was $30, and you got a handful of useless script. You know, East German script. It was like made of tin. It was like Monopoly money, which was only good for buying beer. But you had to spend it while you were there, and you left. But somehow these guys organized a gig, you know, for our, you know, American New York punk rock band. You know, we were playing their guitars, which were made of plywood, and their amplifiers, which were made of like space heaters. You know, it was as DIY as you could possibly imagine. I mean, it was fucking illegal. But you get there, and they say, "We love rock and roll. Have you heard of the Pink Floyd?"
Yeah.
You know, because that was it. This is like pre-internet, and that's all that was drifting over.
It's interesting because a lot of the Israeli punk rockers are of Russian origin and even were born in like Russia or the Ukraine and whatever, and they grew up with that same kind of like, you know, getting a U2 cassette was like really badass.
It's a rare jewel.
And so it kind of makes sense that they then, you know, came into this more Western place and ended up getting into punk rock because it was that same kind of rock is dangerous.
I happen to believe in the electric guitar as a great sign of rebellion, and rock and roll is the great sign of American rebellion for a country that's famous for its revolution. And that translates much more to these countries than anyone who lives here and grew up with it could ever possibly imagine.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Karen's book for a second. Karen,
for more than a second.
For less than 8 minutes. Karen, the main character, the protagonist in your book is Lisa Simon, who's a woman in her late 30s, who's a music fan. And that's usually not the way women are portrayed in sort of rock and roll genre novel sort of thing. Like they're the groupie, they're the wife, they're the singer.
Right, they're not the singer, or they're on the side.
Right.
I wanted to write a book that was that represented my experience and my friend's experience. And, you know, I say on my website, you know, it's if you were ever told, gosh, you know a lot, sure, you know, you sure know a lot about music for a girl, this book is for you.
That's so infuriating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, but let's, I almost kind of want to back it up a little further. I originally called the book Joey Ramone's Dead. And because that was what inspired me to write the book, was Joey's death.
And the inability of the protagonist's boyfriend to grasp the importance of it.
Yes, well...
Lisa Simons, Dave Matthews loving...
Right. Or just... It's everybody who reads this book, male or female, will
There's
have had some of those...
The world to make me listen to the back.
They will have had some of those experiences. I mean, and also it used to be, I mean, at least it used to be when we were all growing up, music, you picked a side. You picked a fucking side.
That's fucking right.
Yes.
You know,
you picked a side that you were on, and there wasn't any of
right.
this sort of like milquetoast, oh, well, you know, I can
Goddamn
understand.
Straight. Aerosmith does not jam with Britney Spears at the Super Bowl. That's just fucking wrong.
Oh, Scott, let's just not even
you
go
know,
there.
You know, when I grew up, it's like, yes,
you
chose sides.
Beatles
side.
Are Stones.
It was more complex than Stones, of course.
You picked you know, a side, and I'm just sort of waiting for the Dave Matthews fans to find out about this, because they're not going to get it. They're not, and I saw a friend trying to sell this book to her friends on Facebook, and she happens to live near Dave Matthews in Wallingford. And I will say that Dave Matthews' politics are right on, and he spends a lot
Very
of money
nice guy, by
in
the way.
Right place in the right places, and he treats his fans like gold. But my God, we have ruined rock and roll because kids used to want to grow up and play
That's
Keith
right.
Richards riffs,
That's right.
and now they want to play guitar like
That's
like
right.
Dave Matthews.
That's
oh,
right.
That is depressing.
Goddamn straight.
But this is
because...
this is and so this yes, this is all what my book is about.
Yes,
but
buy this book.
But the reason, you know, one of the reasons that it was so important to me to try to put it out myself was this is based on the Ramones. This is based on punk rock. And yet you're telling me I now have to engage in, like, the corporate structure of big publishing and hope that... And the reason I signed with the agency that I did was that the woman I originally pitched understood the story and understood that it was a love story and understand it didn't matter if it was the Ramones or if it was the Beatles or if it was, you know, Justin Bieber. It's about loving music, and that music is not just a fucking product.
I love your passion, and that's great, but unfortunately in the game of publishing, your editors who love this book got that, but the marketing douchebag and the sales guy with the pinky ring and the slick back
who
hair did not fucking understand, because they wanted to pigeonhole you and put you into a box, and they don't know your audience.
And here's the thing about this book is that everyone is reading, staying up all night. I keep getting emails and tweets on Twitter, people saying, I stayed up all night reading your book. I can't remember the last time I did that. Huh? I can't wait to read it again. I have a friend who's, you know, this my Dominican friend Wanda, this is not her music, and she read it and like couldn't wait to keep reading it, and has like made a list of all the songs, and she's like, I'm gonna go, this is my rock and roll education.
Wow, that's
and
so
you,
cool.
And you put together a Spotify playlist.
No,
right?
Somebody I don't even know, a friend of mine told her followers, my friend Molly Knight on ESPN tweeted all her followers that this was an awesome book and that you should buy it, and some kid saw the playlist, like I wrote out all the songs that were in the book, and he was so inspired by the playlist and so excited, he went and made a Spotify playlist and said, here's your Spotify playlist that I just made.
No, that's marketing you can't buy. I mean,
exactly.
That's great.
And the best thing that could happen is that it really does catch on and it goes viral, and then somebody will come to you with a big check and say, hey, we want to do your next project.
Or maybe it'll be like Barry Eisler, who's a best-selling author who finally decided, fuck it, I'm going to self-publish and get all the money.
That's right. Hey, like I said, you know, it's easy to self-publish when you're on top of the game.
Yeah.
I mean, theoretically, if I made a record now and I put it on the internet and I put it on iTunes, I've got the same distribution as Ice-T and Prince.
Well, if we want to bitch about Kickstarter again, that's what gets me, when big stars are like, we're going to finance our album.
On Kickstarter.
Like, they don't need Kickstarter.
I haven't seen that. There's a big star doing this?
Like, the people who are making tons of money on Kickstarter, you know,
because I will go and find them and stomp them out.
To start an album, those are people who already have a, you know, big reputation.
Who's
so,
doing this? Name names.
I'm like blanking, of course, now that I brought it up, but it's like, you'll see.
Have been some people that have, if they just went to their fan base and said, pre-order our new single, our new project, their fans would pre-order their new project.
And basically, that's lending somebody money at zero interest.
Yes.
It's bullshit.
So that annoys me. But if it's a startup artist and it's like their first album and their friends want to help them make it happen, I think that's great.
I happen to agree. I do believe in supporting the arts. And like I said, I do it by going to my friends' gigs, by buying their books instead of asking for a free copy, because I know they would gladly give me one. But I'd rather drop a dime on Amazon and then post it on my Facebook page.
And
you know,
if you buy the book on Amazon, you can review review it, and you know, you get
and
like
those reviews actually matter more than people think. So if your friends have written a book, please write a review for them on Amazon, no matter how dumb you think it is, because there are opportunities that are open to self-published offers that require that. X
as
amount
dumb
of
as you
reviews.
Think it is. There's got to be some line drawn.
Write a review.
But I do believe in that. I do believe in that.
Write a review for movies, because I know that reviews on IMDb pages help you get funding and distribution. Do it.
I could use some good Netflix
reviews.
So, Liz, good to know.
This has been the fastest 30 minutes on the internet. But before we go, why don't you tell us quickly about your new project and where we can find you?
You know, we actually got an email question from a listener who wanted to know what Liz's new projects were.
Excellent.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's exciting. Nobody ever talks to us.
It's
probably my mom. Thanks, Mom. Okay, really quickly, since we're running out of time, I'm working on a new film back in Israel. Can't stay away. Too many stories. It's called Battle for Jerusalem. It's not about the battle that people think between Israelis and Palestinians. It's actually an internal kind of conflict among the Jewish population. There's a rapidly growing ultra-Orthodox population in Jerusalem who don't necessarily pay taxes because the men study Torah and the women raise an average 7 children. But there's a secular population which is sort of shouldering the tax burden for all of that population, while the ultra-Orthodox population wants the secular population to become more traditional, more religious. So there's a lot of tension there, and it's actually springing out some really interesting creative movements. Like, it's almost like fertile ground for things like punk and other arts movements. So I'm documenting the young people who are trying to keep Jerusalem pluralistic and open and democratic.
Awesome.
Sounds
so tell our listener where he can find you. He or she can find you.
Battleforjerusalem.com.
Any other, you got a Facebook page we can find you
Twitter,
on?
Twitter, Lizfilm, Lizfilm.
Karen?
I'm Karen, CarynRose. And it's B-Sides and BrokenHearts.com. A-N-D spelled out, no ampersand.
B-Sides and Broken Hearts. I love this book.
Yeah, it's really good.
And I love you, Judy. I do.
I love you.
This
too,
has been
Mike.
This has been our 10th show. This is our 10th show.
Oh wow!
And they said it wouldn't last. So for Mike and Judy and Karen and Liz,
have a fabulous Sunday.
See
Happy
you
summer.
Next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Figure on the Pulp and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th, from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Milk Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexi-Q, Kraft, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Pewter Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery would like to thank our sponsors, Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.